Thank you so very much. Greta, all of you from Georgia and surrounding territory, I am hopeful some of you have not heard me. Now, you know, they said I could talk as long as I wanted to. And if you get tired of listening before I get tired of talking, either raise your hand or leave the room. I won't even notice it because I've been up here reading the 12 promises and it says we'll know a new freedom. I hope in about an hour I will. My name is Jerry Delaney and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Jerry.
There's nothing new under the sun about my story, just told in a little different context in the hope that somebody here might be able to identify, because I had so much trouble identifying along the way. I always get terrified when I look out at a room like this, and these things in front of me terrify me. Now, if some smart engineer would make something that was hidden, I would love him for life. You notice I say him. I always like being a woman. And I would hate to lose the men in the world. They've been pretty important to me at times. I'm thrilled to be back in Georgia because I always have a good time here. Not that I don't have a good time every day I live. You know, when you get my age and you open your eyes, you're very grateful. You got a plus right there. And you put your feet on the floor, you got two, and you look around and you're sober. You got three, and you got friends like you, that's four. What do you got to worry about? There's nothing left to worry about. So I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm thankful to have so many friends all over the world. Today I'm particularly thankful to Caritha for introducing me, to Sue for putting up with my new secretary. God love her. I'm afraid she isn't an alcoholic, that's the trouble. If she'd drink a little bit more. And Jackie, I'm grateful to you for putting up with George. He just set me up too. You know what he said? He said, are you an alcoholic? Are you going to talk about alcohol? And I thought maybe no, I wouldn't. I'd talk about sex and a single girl. I'll fix you. He's been having a hard time with his women. He'll have a harder time with me. All I know about alcoholics, and particularly me, I've learned since I got into AA, because you see, I became an alcoholic after I came to AA. I was not an alcoholic when I came. You understand that. You will later. I'm glad this is a family affair because my family were filled with drunks. Now, I didn't have any alcoholics in my family when I arrived. I had a moral leper of a brother. He drank too much. And I had trouble with him. I had to do something about him. And I called a child psychiatrist, the only one in the United States at the time. And I thought a child psychiatrist was particularly important for a moral leper like that. And asked him what I should do about my brother who drank too much. And he said, Jerry, I don't know. Now, wait a minute. He said, I went to a medical meeting in New York the other night. And he said there was a guy there by the name of Bill Wilson and some men, and they're doing something peculiar with men who drink too much. You notice that said men who drink too much. He gave me his card, now call him up. And he did. He called up Bill. And God bless him, he gathered up two men and went out to New Jersey to see my brother. October 1st of 1940, and he stayed sober thereafter. Every day, for which I am extremely grateful, because it helped me much along the way. When you read the preamble, you left out one word. In the beginning, it had an honest desire to stop drinking. They took the honest out, I think, after I came in. because I didn't have any honest desire to stop drinking. I had an honest desire to get you off my back. I had an honest desire to feel better. I had an honest desire to get my job back. I had a lot of desires, but none of them had anything to do with drinking, you understand. When I talk about being sober a long time, some of you don't understand that. But I do want you to remember that being sober a long time doesn't give me a license to stop going to meetings, doesn't give me a license to stop my inventory. It doesn't give me a license to do any of the things that I didn't do when I was first sober. I need AA more today than I needed after I'd been 5 years sober. And I have to remember that my sobriety is just one day at a time in the AA way of life. And if I forget that, I will be one day drunk. I must never forget from whence I came. I identify with the young people a great deal because in my day, alcohol was illegal. And all these nice medications that you hear about were legal. And I didn't want those. I had them around, but I didn't want them. I've always worked for and with the medical profession. And, you know, you bathe in that stuff. But I wanted to be popular, that more than anything else. And at age 18, I didn't drink, but I started running booze across the Canadian border. Had a nice little way of carrying it, hot water bottles filled with booze strung between my legs. You had to put cotton pants on so they didn't squeak. And you practiced 3 weeks so that if they asked you to get out of the car, you wouldn't be awkward. And when I came back with 2 quarts of Canadian whiskey when we were drinking Rotgut, I was very popular. Now, I didn't drink it then, understand, but I was working for the medical profession, and there was an old hag came around our office, and I now know she was an alcoholic because for a slight fee, she'd sell me an extra gallon of uncut alcohol, which is the strength of 2 gallons now that you drink now. It was in a tin, and I would take it to the party. And I want you to know I was popular at that party with a gallon of uncut alcohol. Let me tell you something. We could make bathtub gin now. Some of you young ones that don't know what bathtub gin is, you cut it with alcohol with a little water, you put a little juniper juice in it, you age it 15 minutes and drink it in hard cider, and you fly, particularly if you've been taking phenobarbital. My lying started very early in the game. Because I thought I was entitled, you remember this is a disease of entitlement, I was entitled to a little relaxation because I had tried a little drink one night when I took the gallon to the party. And you know what it did for me? It made me tall. It made me beautiful. I didn't have a crooked nose. I didn't have big ears. I didn't have buck teeth. I danced divinely. I have never been that beautiful since. But I tried. I tried very hard. And after having that, I thought, well, after all, I am a little tired. I ought to have a little bit at home at night, don't you think? I'm entitled to have a little bit at home. And so I took a quart out before I took it to the party, and nobody said anything. They couldn't see through the tin. They didn't know whether it was full or not. But you see, the trouble was I knew. And right then started my alcoholic lying. lying to me. It doesn't make any difference whether I lie to you or not, but it makes an awful lot of difference if I lie to me, because then I can't tell you the truth. So I changed that, lying. The next time I got a gallon, and we didn't get it every weekend, understand? Next time I got a gallon, I took a quart out, and I put a quart of water in. That makes it all right, doesn't it? I drank and worked and took pills in the morning because they don't smell and I didn't shake. But I loved booze. I loved booze, and I wanted to drink every time I could, but I couldn't always get it along the way. While I was drinking, as I say, I got this moral leper of a brother of mine into that thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was going to those meetings all the time. And I wasn't very happy about him going to meetings. He didn't say, "Why don't you do what I do?" He didn't say anything. But he went to meetings, and I called him a moral leper, and I drank in front of him, and I did everything that I could possibly do. I didn't understand why his wife wasn't very nice to me, because I'd supported her for years, made her pay through the nose for every cent I gave her. And I had plenty of money at the time, so it didn't make any difference. Came the time when he began to get calls about me not being so well. I was overworking, and I would be in hospitals all over the United States because I traveled with the medical group 8 months out of the year. And I would get a little too drunk, and I would get in the hospital. Of course, I always looked up the best psychiatrist in every city. Not because I was going to consult him, but he was a backup, so he'd keep me out of the nut house and in a private room. Time went on, they'd call my brother, and he wouldn't come, and they thought he was mean, I heard a little bit later. Then came the time when I was unconscious for 10 days from an overdose. I don't remember this, but they told me about it. When I came out of it, they said, "You almost died." And I laughed in their face and said, "You can't kill the Irish." And I was drunk in 3 hours. That, my friends, is insanity. And yet when I came to AA, I said, "Who's insane?" Insane in its simplest form is not whole and not normal. And I certainly wasn't whole, and I certainly wasn't normal. Unconscious for 10 days and then drinking again. It wasn't very long after that that I waked up one morning, and you know how you always look at the ceiling to see if it's yours? I don't know whether you did or not, but I did. And you looked over next to you to see if you were alone, and I usually was. I was not a very acceptable drunk because I would go to the ladies' room and then walk out and get in a cab and disappear. They weren't very happy about that. But I looked next to me and there wasn't anybody there. But when I looked at the ceiling, it wasn't mine, and I looked in the windows, and my windows at home didn't have bars on them. And I looked at the door, and there's that little peephole. You know, as O'Keefe said, sloppy architect didn't put knobs on the inside the door. And I, in my brilliance, you understand that I was an intellectual at the time. In my great brilliance, I deduced that I was in the nut house. And that's right where I was. And for the first time, I got a little honest and said, "If I ever get out of here, I'll ask my brother if he'll help me. I didn't call him a leper for the first time in over 6 years. Now, I'd been going to AA meetings with him out in Morristown, New Jersey, one of the places, and it was a cute little organization. Why, they had a cake big like this in the shape of a bottle and had three feathers sticking out of it. Cute thing. You know, they did such cute. But they were praying all the time. You know, and who wanted to go with that bunch of holy rollers? But that morning, I was looking for a miracle. And you know something? I got it. Because it wasn't more than 20 minutes that my brother appeared at that door. He had flown in from New York to Chicago in the night. He'd had to borrow AA money to come. He didn't have any of his own. His AA friends loaned him money. And he didn't say anything to me except, "Honey, you've made a pretty lousy mess out of your life. Do you want to do something about it?" And I did want to do something about it, but as I say, I didn't want to go out with that bunch of holy rollers. But being the liar that I was, and that most alcoholics are, I said, yes, I did want to do something about it. And then he made an important statement. And if there's any family in the room, alcoholic or not alcoholic, I hope you'll remember this. He said, "Honey, I love you too much to be objective about you. I can't help you." And my heart fell. And then he resumed, "But I'll get somebody to help you." And I flew back, and I'll never forget that flight because we couldn't land in Newark because of storms. We finally landed and got a limousine into Newark. Over the hills, I was used to flat country. I'm hungover, no pills, no alcohol, 48 hours sober. Oh, God. 19 years of medication, and the last 17 on booze. Because they started me on pills when I was 17 because I was nervous. They would call me hyperkinetic now. In those days, they called me a nasty little brat. I think they were right. But they gave me those things that were going to cure the ills of the nation, and I didn't like them. But I did take them. But here I was coming off of all that stuff cold turkey. There weren't any rehabs in those days. And we ended up in Newark. My brother was a professor, and he had to teach a class. And he left me sitting in the hotel lobby with no money, no pills, no booze. Well, I sat there a while. I was shaking to pieces. I finally got myself together, and I went in the ladies' room, and I'm going to fix my hair up, you know, and maybe go in the bar and pick up a little drink from one of the gentlemen. And I took a look at myself in the mirror and gave that up. It was awful. I'll never forget that. My hair was stringing down and my eyes were blurry and I didn't have any makeup on and, oh, I was a mess. And I'm not the most attractive creature in the world anyway. And without all that stuff, you see, you put a little of this and a little of that on, it comes out not too bad. By my standards, that is. But I didn't have any of those things, and so I sat there. And they started taking me to meetings. Now, they weren't nice, like everybody is now, you know. They say to you, "Dear, would you like to go to a meeting?" They said, "Come on, we're going to a meeting." No. Sit on a front row. Little sawed-off sergeant from Fort Monmouth. I'll never forget him as long as I live. All he said to me was, "Shut up." Shut up. Shut up. One day I got nerve enough and I said, I thought you could do AA any way you want to. You don't have a way. And he looked down his nose and he was a head shorter than I was. They took me to meetings, and thanks be to God, the wives went to all of the meetings in those days. It was a family affair. They went to all the meetings, and they were very, very good to me, and I shall always be grateful to the non-alcoholic women for the things they did to me. Because, you see, at that time, there were only four women in AA in New Jersey. And the men didn't want women in that nice little men's club of theirs. And they weren't very nice to us. But we banded together. And just before I came down here, seven of the gals who were in our first women's group that started about 35 years ago had come out to see me. They were up from Florida and all sorts of places. And it was simply wonderful to see them in varying stages of falling to pieces, just like the rest of us. But we went to meetings, and we sat back, and we relaxed, and we listened. And you know something? A little bit at a time, something began to happen to me. Somebody said to me along the way, don't be afraid to ask dumb questions. They're more easily handled than your dumb mistakes. And so I got over feeling so dumb. And they told me to look a long time at the things that pleased me, and even a longer time at the things that gave me pain, because I was going to have to get rid of them. I believe of all the things that caused me trouble in AA were words. I fought every step of the way for the first 5 years. I've enjoyed every step of the way since. I don't deserve to be alive. And yet, as I'm creeping up on my 77th birthday, have a full-time job working 12 to 14 hours a day, 7 days a week because I want to, and working with alcoholics, and particularly the young people, they're such a joy to me. I could string them up, understand, and I could beat them to death, but I love them just the same. Along the way, I forgot to tell you, I got in some of that fraternizing business, and I married another alcoholic. Now, if any of you girls think it's easier being married to an alcoholic, forget it. Men and women never think alike. Don't make any difference whether they're both alcoholic or not. But I married this Irishman, and I want to tell you, he was a 49-year-old bachelor, had never been married, Roman Catholic, and came complete with aged mother. I was raised in a hard-shell Baptist family, career, divorced. And I didn't fit in there too well. Yeah, but you know something? I loved him the day I married him, and I loved him the day he died. I could have stuck a butcher knife to him 100 times, turned it around, watched him bleed to death, and laughed, and I'm sure he felt the same about me. But we did love each other in spite of the fact that we liked to kill. We learned differently, but we did learn some of the same things along the way. He didn't mind words like I did, because Tom spent time on the Bowery. He was a man who could look dirtier than anybody I ever saw and more handsome than anybody I ever saw. And the girls were always said, oh, I wish I were married to Tom. And I said, you can have him, but don't touch. I paid $3 for him. He made me pay for the license. That's how smart he was. I didn't like the word alcoholic. I don't mind alcohol, understand, but that ick on the end of it is that's a dirty thing. Now, if it had been called Jelinek's disease after the great Dr. Jelinek, I would have been very happy. Going for Jelinek's therapy was more my style. But they didn't call it Jelinek's therapy. They did try to change the name along the way from alcoholism to Jelinek's disease, but they didn't make it. And I didn't like the word disease. That was dirty, too. But certainly, I was ill at ease when I was drinking, unless I was ossified. And if I was ossified, I couldn't function. And certainly, alcohol affected me differently than it did other people, but I couldn't see that. And now I know it is a disease of the body, the mind, and the spirit. An altered function of the body or mind is the definition Webster uses for disease. Certainly our thinking was altered, and my body was. I don't know about yours. I began to hear people say about me as I was coming off drugs, and I hope you'll be careful about what you say around where people might hear. That sister of Oscar's may be a nice girl, but she's got a screw loose. And it wasn't tacked down too tight, I'll have to admit. But it hurt my feelings at the time. I heard somebody say, well, she's paranoid. Well, now I laugh at it because I should have been suspicious. They were watching me like a hawk. They took me to work. My sister-in-law wouldn't let me go to the bathroom by myself. She knew I'd jump out the window and go get something to drink. They said I was manic depressive. Well, I was. One minute I was up in the ceiling, you couldn't get me with a sky hook, and the next in the basement, and you couldn't dig me up with a spade. I was all over the lot. It was terrible. I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but I wouldn't not have it that way because it taught me something that I needed to know, that there was something greater than I was, and it had to do with booze, and the recovery had to do with the God of my understanding. I had gotten a lot of response during my illness by using the word depression. I'm depressed. That got me all sorts of attention. Well, unfortunately, one of my alcoholics along the way spoiled depression for me. She said, you know what depression is? It's unresolved discontent. And I was discontented, but I didn't want to resolve it the way they wanted me to. That was the point. I wanted to do it my way. My way was better. I didn't understand that it didn't make any difference how much I drank or when I drank, but it was what happened to me. Because I said, I didn't drink as much as John. I didn't drink as much as so-and-so. I didn't go to jail. I wasn't like my brother. My brother neglected his family. My brother overspent his budget. And my brother went to jail for leaving the scene of an accident. Horrible thing. I wasn't like that. Well, I wasn't married. I didn't have a family to neglect. Number two, I traveled on an unlimited expense account, and I was the auditor, so I didn't have any trouble with my budget. And one morning, I looked out the window at my car. You know how you look out to see if it's there? It was there all right, but one side was gone and I never knew where I left it. These are the things that led me to believe that I might have a problem of one sort or another. Of course, it wasn't booze. You understand that. I said when I came to AA that I never had any blackouts. I didn't understand that a blackout is a true amnesia where I walked, I talked, and I functioned, but I simply had no recall. My brain's a little bit like the recording machine. If the battery's low, it sometimes doesn't record, and when my battery was low when I was on booze, I didn't remember. At first, I acknowledged that I had a few short blackouts. Oh, you know, just little ones. But I'd been sober 10 years, and a girlfriend came to see me that I hadn't seen since I was sober, and she said, "Jerry, can I ask you a question?" "Yep." She said, "That night you were out to my house in Springfield, and a light bulb went on. I didn't remember her house in Springfield. She said, you were driving your car. I think you'd had something to drink. I had told you up until that time I never drove a car when I was drinking." And the last thing she said was, "Why did they throw you out of the hotel?" I don't remember any hotel. I don't know where it was. I don't remember what I said to her. I was horrified, because I knew right then that I had had blackouts lasting at least 5 days. And that's a scary, scary thing. They kept talking about being humble in AA, and I couldn't stand being humble, go around in sackcloth and ashes. You see, it was words that were bothering me, the things they were saying from the platform. And I came to realize that humility is simply an honest opinion of what I'm really worth today. Not yesterday, not 10 years ago, today. What am I doing today? And then I saw that word wisdom in the AA prayer. That word wisdom bothered me a lot. And then I came upon a definition for wisdom. Wisdom is simply common sense developed to an uncommon degree. I had common sense. I could develop it, couldn't I? You see, I no longer was the intellectual brat. I had lost that, and that was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And for the first time in my life, I began to be truly comfortable. I wasn't comfortable as a child. I wasn't comfortable as a successful young woman. Just before I got sober, I had lost this great job of mine. You see, the doctors were a little worried about me, and they sent me to the Mayo Clinic. And the head neuropsychiatrist examined me and kept me under his guidance for 3 solid months. And he was a good psychiatrist. You know what his diagnosis was? She's not an alcoholic or a drug addict. She's outrageously overworked and underpaid. You know, he died 2 years ago, and he never did believe that I was an alcoholic, but I said, "Phil, if I'm not, I'll do until one comes along." But you'd think I could. That man loved me, admired me, and he did not want to say I was an alcoholic, because he too didn't like the word alcoholic. I don't know whether he drank or not. I never knew that much. But he always said that I worked too hard. And you know, right now, I never worked harder in my life. I never was paid less. I never had more fun. And I enjoy working. I love it. The word love bothered me a great deal. And then I finally got a definition that works for me. Love is understanding, whether we approve or not. I love every one of you. I may not approve of what you do, but I don't have to. I just have to try to understand what makes you tick. I learned along the way that we all have to be careful of the trigger drugs. You see, alcohol heads a family of drugs, and all of these little things come under it. The phenobarbital, the Valium, the Librium, the God knows what. Now we got Trancine, and you add the stomach acid to that, and it becomes Valium. We always think the new drugs are all right for us. And the new drugs become old drugs, and they aren't all right. For you and me, if we want to stay sober, we've got to watch out and not have our thinking change. When our thinking starts to change, we better run, not walk, to the nearest AA meeting. We better call up a friend. And I urge you to have 6-day numbers and 6-night numbers. They may not be the same, and out of 12 numbers, somebody ought to be home, and by the time you've dialed 12 numbers, you will have forgotten why you were so upset anyway. I urge you to watch the food. I came close to starting again on a New Year's Eve party where the non-alcoholics were being given white grape juice under charge. And the non-alcoholics were given champagne, and the alcoholics were given white grape juice under charge. You know something? That white grape juice tickled my nose like champagne. It smelled like champagne. And my thinking became different. I began, even though I was happily married, 6 years at the time, I began thinking about a love affair where I drank a lot of champagne and the man played. Do you know I thought about that off and on for 3 weeks? I've never touched that stinking stuff since. And that's flaming stuff that you get in the restaurants, you say it all cooks off. It isn't what cooks off that you like, it's what drops down in the juice. That's the alcohol. That didn't burn off. Alcohol is alcohol, and I don't care how you take it. Whether you take it in squished forms or snuff it up your nose or what you do with it doesn't really make much difference. You know, recovery is a little like a three-legged stool. We have to get rigorously honest. And that getting rigorously honest is awfully hard for me. Now, it may not be hard for you. You may be just naturally, normally honest, but I wasn't. And I had a terrible time. And somebody suggested that the only way I could tell whether I was being honest or not was to have some standards to measure by. I had to get some standards or I wouldn't know whether I was being honest or whether I was doing right or not. And they asked me as the first standard, what do you really stand for? And are you firm enough in your belief to enforce what you believe without getting mad? When you're talking to another alcoholic, if you believe what you believe, don't get angry if they don't believe it. Drop it. You know something? All of my standards have been given to me by older alcoholics. I can remember one day talking to Walter Benfield, God rest his soul, about a man's wife. And I said, oh, Walter, she's no good anyway. And he said, Jerry, do you know her that well? What you say carries a good deal of weight. Have you met her? And I was horrified to realize that I didn't know her from Adam's or Fox. You know something? That I cried, yes. I felt badly. And incidentally, there's nothing wrong with tears. They're the floodgate of the soul. Cry if you want to. Don't be ashamed of your tears. And I cried, but you know, from that day to this, I have never made a statement about anyone that I didn't know to be true of myself. No gossip. I had to get that out of my system right then. I have to ask myself if I have standards, whether or not I respect myself enough that I don't have to punish myself when things don't come out right. I have to ask myself if my goals in life are realistic. You know, my goals today aren't quite what they were when I came in AA at 39 years old. They've had to change a little bit. Well, some of them have. Anyway, in your family affairs, how do you get along with your family? Do you let them live too, or do they have to live your way? They're entitled to live the way they want to live. And you have a choice to stay or to go. Just that easy. If you go, there are some problems, some consequences. If you stay, there's some consequences. Write down what you're going to do. Inventory was always a stinker for me. I had a terrible time, but you know something? It saved my life because I take a yearly written inventory. I take a daily mini inventory. But on my vacation in January, after I've rested 2 weeks, I start to write my inventory. How have I done with my assets first? Because we do have assets, my friends. How have I done with my assets? Have I let any of them slip? If they slipped, why? Didn't I pay enough attention to them? One of my assets might be going regularly to meetings. Why didn't I go? And an inventory of my liabilities. And I give them priorities of which ones need to be handled first. And then I make plans of how I'm going to handle them. It's one thing acknowledging them, but if you aren't going to do anything about them, what's the use of acknowledging them? Do I want to get rid of them? Well, if they're liabilities, they must give me trouble. I don't try to do the whole list at once. I do it one at a time. That's the way they tell me to live. One day at a time, one thing at a time. It works in all of my life, the whole thing. My rate of recovery hasn't been that swift. But I have a little sign in my house that says, God grant me the serenity to accept my own rate of recovery. I don't have to be so fussy about it. I do believe that the way in which we work the program is up to us. I can sit where you're sitting today and listen to the speaker, and there must be one thing that I will get that will help me, or there's something terribly wrong with me. I went to a meeting the other night, and I slipped in the back, and I heard a young man, and by the way, the young seem to be more spiritual than some of us old ones. I heard a young man saying, you know, I knew I had to respect God. I knew I had to love God. But today I like God. And I felt that this was important, that I like the God of my understanding. When I came to AA, I didn't want to use the word God. I didn't want to have any part of it. Somebody said, well, G-O-D could be good orderly direction. You know, I've ended up with the initials that are mine, myself, G-O-D, Jerry Owen Delaney. You know something? I can have good orderly direction. And I can have a God that I understand, something outside myself that is more powerful than I am. Along the way, I began to want to talk to this God of mine. And I had many people help me. And one of my clergy friends said, just talk to them, talk to him as you would your best friend, for he has been your best friend, and certainly mine. He kept me alive. And I said, well, do I have to get down on my knees to pray? He said, well, Jerry, it'd be good exercise for your knees, but for heaven's sake, don't forget to get up off your knees and go to work. Said, you should have seen this mess that you were in when God had it alone. And so I get up off my knees. He comes down to about 10 words for me. If it is to be, it's up to me. You can give me ideas and you can give me help, but you can't do it for me. I must take action. I can be the smartest kid in the graveyard if I don't take action. And action is attention to little things in my work and at home. Attention to little things in AA. I don't know about you, but I carry a notebook and write things down. You know why? My memory isn't so good, never has been. And I get out and I say, what was it he said about so-and-so? But if I've got a little pencil, I can write it down. I don't have to say who said it or anything about it. Something that'll help me. If I'm going to take action, I've got to cooperate. I've got to cooperate with my friends, with my AA members, with my family, and with my boss. They might be able to give me a better way. AA has given me a better way. They might just happen to. And then I have to take time. That's the T in action. Time for planning. Time for learning. Because these are terrific experiences. And I have to be interested. Interested in you. And maybe have a little intuition. Those are important eyes. And under the O, there's so many things. What I expect of myself, is it realistic? And N in action, never give up. Never give up what you have today. Nothing succeeds like success, and AA works. We don't have to take it apart and put it back together again. Just leave it as it is. 12 nice, simple steps of work if you follow them. Every day, you don't step from the first to the 12th. You walk up the stairs one at a time. Every single day, it's a program, a way of life. And so today, I'm thankful for so many things. And I wrote a little piece because I wanted to see one night what I had to thank the Lord for. And it came out to thank you, Lord. T is for the time that you have allowed me to be in AA and help others through my work. And H is for the warm hearts that have extended their hand to help me along the way. And every one of you have helped me today. You've listened so patiently. And A is for the God-given ability to be a good example to just one other person. And N is for the new way of life that has made me a lady in my own eyes, because I was not a lady in my eyes when I was drinking. I wanted to be. I wanted to be. But I thought it was all dress and trappings. And now I know it's in my heart. And the K in thank you, Lord, is for the tremendous knowledge of alcoholism that I've been able to get from so many brilliant people along the line who've given so generously to me. Knowing Bill and Lois, having them in my home many times for weekends, Marty Mann, many of the old-timers, had been wonderful for me. And why in you is for the yesterdays in my life, including the pain that helped me become strong today, because it was our pain that made us see we had to change. And oh, is for the objectivity in dealing with myself and other individuals. And you is for universal understanding that I find throughout the world among recovering alcoholics. I found that in foreign places, but every time I walked in the door, whether I could understand the language or not, love was in that room. And the Ellen, Lord, is thank you for the love and understanding, whether you approve or not. And the love I've received from this group, and always for the opportunity to own my own life, not only with its successes, but with its failures, to be able to admit them. And R is for the results of victory that we can all savor if we wish. And D is for the daily opportunity to learn each day. For these things, and much, much more, O Lord, I thank you. And so today, as we go out to have a bite to eat and to come back and hear John, and I'm going to enjoy John tonight like you can't believe, because I don't have to do any more but sit and soak it up. God bless you, John. You're in my thoughts tonight, but I'll be here. And I'd like to leave you with a prayer that was adapted for AA, and I don't know who the author is, and I don't know where I've got it. I've had it for years. Lord, you know better than I know myself that I am growing older in AA 24 hours at a time. Keep me from getting talkative, and particularly from the fatal habit of thinking that I must say something on every occasion and on every subject. Release me from trying to straighten out everybody's affairs, and keep my mind free from the recital of endless details. Give me wings to get to the point. I ask grace enough to listen to the tales of others' pains and problems. Help me to endure them with patience. Seal my lips on my aches, pains, and problems. They may have increased, but my love of rehearsing them has become sweeter as the years roll by. Teach me the glorious lesson that occasionally it's possible that I might be mistaken. Keep me reasonably sweet. I don't want to be a saint. They're increasing, and some of them are so hard to live with. Jackie, would you approve? But a sour old-timer in AA is one of the crowning works of the devil. Make me thoughtful but not moody, helpful but not bossy. With my vast store of wisdom, it seems such a pity not to be able to use it all. But thou knowest, Lord, I want and need friends even as the years roll by. May God bless each and every one of you and give you many days just as he's given me today. God bless you.